We're going to switch gears now and change gears to something totally different, a very interesting topic that's getting a lot of attention here at the AAAS meeting in Seattle, and that is we're going to the dogs. We're going to talk about dogs. And, you know, everybody who has a dog thinks they know, you know, what their dog is like and has its personality. But dogs are also very interesting to study and see how they got to be the way they are. According to an article in the Atlantic Monthly, Americans love their dogs. They spend more than $5 billion a year on dog food, $7 billion on canine veterinary care. So it's no wonder that we want to find out what makes our faithful companions tick. And plenty of scientists are doing just that. In some cases, they're delving deeply into the DNA of the dog, not just that one dog, but all dogs, to find out more about their evolutionary history and to find new ways to prevent and treat dog diseases and perhaps find out what dogs and humans might have in common. Why are they called man's best friend? And what is it that makes a dog a dog? Everybody who has a dog has their own ideas. And how are they different from wolves? Always heard, you know, the dogs are descended from wolves. How are they different? One of my guests today says that dogs can actually read human social cues better than wolves and our closest genetic relatives, chimpanzees. Dogs do better than chimpanzees in reading our cues. And instead of the faithful companion, he says that the dogs might better be labeled human tool users. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about what he means by this. So if you'd like to talk about dogs, where they came from, what we can learn from them, and how the breeds have progressed, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Robert Wayne is an evolutionary biologist at the University of California in Los Angeles. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here, Ira.
Elaine Ostrander works on the Canine Genome Project. She is a member in the Division of Human Biology at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center and affiliate professor at the University of Washington here in Seattle. Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Ostrander.
Thank you for inviting me.
Gordon Lark is a professor of biology at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. Thank you for traveling all the way across the state.
Glad to be here.
Joining us. Brian Hare is an anthropologist, soon to be at the Max Planck Institute in Germany, and he's just finishing his doctoral work at Harvard. Thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Hare. Robert Wayne, I mean, perhaps the biggest question surrounding, people say, they talk about their dogs. They want to know, when did the dog become a dog? When did dogs first show up? And there have been all kinds of theories and dates put to these things. You have an interesting date of your own.
Well, let me say first, the archaeological data suggests something on the order of 12 to 14,000 years for the first dog to appear. I think the genetic data is a little bit equivocal, but at least our study suggested a much older origin, something maybe on the order of 100,000 years. Now, there's a newer study that was published in Science a few years ago that suggests, well, perhaps the genetic data can be compatible with a 15,000-year origin. But I think in general, on balance, the genetic data push the date of origin back maybe on the order of 40, 50,000 years.
So you use the DNA of the dogs to trace back when they change?
Absolutely. You look at DNA sequences, and you compare them, different dogs to each other and dogs to wolves, and you ask how different they are. And then you use a rough molecular clock to approximate when they shared a common ancestor, basically.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Elaine Ostrander. You're involved in the Dog Genome Project, so you're
right.
Trying to decipher the dog genome.
Absolutely.
And why do we want to know about the dog genome?
Well, lots of reasons. First of all, as our closest companions, it's not surprising they share the same environment as we do, and they also get all the same diseases that we get. And so many scientists have been interested in identifying the genes responsible for those diseases, with the idea that if you can figure out what causes epilepsy and cancer and heart disease and blindness and deafness in dogs, you can gain some insight as to what's causing the same diseases in humans.
So dogs get breast cancer too?
Yeah. Like that? Yeah, they do. They get pretty much most of the same range of cancers that humans do with different frequencies. So prostate cancer is very common in humans, not so common in dogs. Lymphoma and osteosarcoma are big problems in mm-hmm. canine health.
Let's talk a little bit more about where dogs and wolves broke off. How do we know where, what the defining moment was there? Were they discovered by humans, or what was the interaction? Do we know what the social interaction was at all?
Not really. Yeah. The only evidence we have, of course, is in DNA sequences, which tell us something about relationships, and in the archaeological record, which tell us something about when dogs begin to look like dogs as we know them and become associated with humans. Using that skeletal material to make inferences about behavior and interactions is somewhat difficult, as you can imagine.
Yeah. Gordon Lark, it's only recently in your career that you've become involved in canine genetics. What happened?
Well, it's a little bit embarrassing.
We like that.
My dog died. It was a Portuguese water dog, and I wanted to get another Portuguese water dog. And I found a breeder, and she said, well, that's fine. I think I can let you have one of my puppies, but what do you do? I don't like my dogs to go to the wrong home. So I tried to convince her the dog would always be with me at the lab and so on. Yes, but what do you do? Well, I'm a soybean geneticist. And what she heard was blah, 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 genetics, blah, 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 blah. And we started talking genetics over the phone. She was tremendously well-informed. And after the gestation was over and the dog was born and trained and ready to leave, I said, you know, I know these dogs are expensive. I need to send you a check. And she said, I'm sending you a dog free so you'll feel guilty and work on dog genetics. And that's quite literally how this started.
And it worked then, obviously.
Well, we had been talking about using an animal model to look at genome architecture, which we'd been doing with the soybean. And the problem was, what model? And we couldn't afford to keep animals anyway in the lab. So the challenge was, could dogs be studied when they were kept by their owners? And of course, one obvious answer is that's how human genetics is studied. Nobody keeps the humans in the lab. So
let me write that down. Yeah.
So, but I told her, you know, it was very unlikely that Utah people had started this whole thing with human genetics, and you need just the right population to do this. So she and two others sent me 5,000 pedigrees within a few months. So that told us they were really serious. And it turned out, miracle of miracles, that the Portuguese water dog was a beautiful population for just this kind of study.
Wow.
And the owners were tremendously health-oriented. So, for example, to know if we could do this, we sent tape measures to 500 owners and asked them to tell us how long their dog was, how high it was at the hock, and so on. You couldn't get worse measurements, right?
Right.
I mean, we got 300 responses, and even with these bad measurements, we found out that 8 out of 12 measurements were heritable. That is to say, the genetics could be studied.
All right, we're gonna have to break away. We'll come back and talk more about the study and about how your dog controls you, actually. So, and why, and how it responds to your hidden cues, and how it makes cues that help. It's really interesting. We'll talk with Brian here when we get back, so stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about the genetics and evolution of the dog with Robert Wayne, Elaine Ostrander, Gordon Lark, and Brian Hare. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Brian, let's talk a bit about your research about dogs and how they got to be dogs. Tell us about did they descend from wolves? Is that what we believe what happened?
That's what the geneticists have found, absolutely. And what we've been doing is comparing dogs' ability to solve problems relative to other animals, such as wolves and even chimpanzees. And what we've been finding is that they have some unusual abilities that we think may have played a large role in them being skillful in manipulating and predicting our behavior.
Tell us a little bit about
absolutely. That, yeah. So we use a really simple test that we've developed to compare lots of different animals. The test has to be simple so that we can compare animals that have hands and animals that don't have hands and right. things like this. So what we do is we have two cups, and we spread them apart about a meter apart, and then we hide food underneath one of the cups. So the animal knows there's food in one of the cups, but just doesn't know which one it's hidden in. And as a nice human, we try to tell the animal using a gesture or a cue. We try to tell the animal where the food is.
You point to the cup?
That's right. We'll point to the cup, or we'll look at the cup, or we'll just move our eyes and look at the cup. And what we found is that relative to wolves and even chimpanzees, our closest relative, who are very sophisticated, dogs are really the champ. They're ahead of the pack.
So to speak.
That's right.
So they get the cue from that. And do they then put that into their repertoire of cues from humans?
So that test is really just a proxy of their ability. We just to allow us to compare dogs to different species. But what I think that means is that in daily life, dogs are really paying attention to our body motions, gestures, cues, to figure out what we want and what we don't want, and then they can come up with a plan to get what they want.
Mm-hmm. And how has this helped breeding dogs down through the ages and selecting out for these things we want to see in dogs?
Well, I think actually it may not have been intentional at all. It may have been more that dogs that had these abilities were better able to survive and reproduce. It's unclear that initially, this ability evolved because people wanted dogs who could figure out what they wanted. And we've done a new study where we've found some direct support, a new study that's unpublished, comparing dogs, modern companion dogs, to an ancient breed of dog called the New Guinea singing dog. I've been working with Janice Kohler-Matsnick, the New Guinea Singing Dog Conservation Society, and we found that the New Guinea singing dogs, who have had very little contact with humans for thousands of years, are very poor at these same tests. So it looks like dogs who were exposed to humans for millennia developed these abilities over many, many generations.
Would they do this to please people? I mean, would they try to please their humans and then therefore naturally select out so they'd survive for the next round?
Exactly. That's the idea. The dog who could figure out how to make humans happy or stay out of trouble are the dogs who would survive and reproduce, and that's where this ability came from. That's right.
But we see today people trying to breed these things into dogs. And, you know, you don't get such great dogs out sometimes.
That's right. Well, here's the interesting fact that I don't think many people know. So the truth is lots of breeders and trainers have great information about differences in dogs' ability to solve problems and trainability and such. But science has almost completely ignored dogs. So our research comparing dogs to different species is some of the first research comparing the problem-solving abilities or cognition of dogs. So really it's an open question whether different breeds differ, have different abilities to solve problems relative to other breeds.
Could you try to try other kinds of dog-like animals like wolves or foxes and see if you can make them think like the dog does? Is it possible?
Oh, absolutely. So that's interesting. That's a great question. If you give chimpanzees, wolves, foxes, whatever you want, if you give them enough exposure, they will learn how to use the cues and find the food. The trick is, though, that dogs are very flexible and they can generalize their abilities to lots of new situations and don't need lots of experience, whereas other species, each new cue, each new test, they need lots of experience.
Could we see this, Elaine, I'll ask you to jump in maybe, could we see the genes in dogs that would say, hey, this dog is going to be a better, catching? Or
absolutely.
You can see this in the dogs.
I think one could. I think the genome resources are in hand to ask those kinds of questions. And so one of the things we know is that different breeds of dogs have very different behaviors that they're strikingly good at. So there are herding dogs that like to herd, and there are draft dogs that like to pull, and there are pointers, and there are hunting dogs, and so on. And with the sequence of the canine genome becoming available this spring, and with the dense maps that have been produced by several groups, including my own, certainly the resources are in hand to now go to breeds of dogs and populations of dogs and say, what are the genes that are responsible for these very striking, very reproducible, and very heritable differences in behavior?
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Patricia in San Rafael. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. I direct the Canine Health Program at Guide Dogs for the Blind. We have campuses in California and Oregon. And my organization's goal is to improve both the health and the temperament and the cognition of future guide dogs. And I was wondering how your panelists view these goals and how they might be met with some of the new genetic technologies. We want to help Mother Nature and not harm her in the process.
Dr. Ostrander?
Yeah, so I'm familiar with your organization and some of the scientists that you've collaborated with or been talking with, and the recent meetings sort of bringing together people with your goals and scientists that took place in New Jersey. So I think those are very reachable goals. I think organizations like yours have an enormous amount of information about what makes a good guide dog and have developed really terrific tests for things like temperament and what kinds of temperament are really suitable for guide dogs. Putting that together with genetics groups like mine that have the ability to quickly scan through a genome and say what a group of dogs with a particular set of features has in common, that a group of dogs who lack those features or lack those abilities or lack that temperament don't have, I think is something that's very, very doable at this point in time. But really what it takes is DNA samples or cheek swabs from the populations of dogs that we want to look at or we want to examine and study. So I think the steps your organization has made to begin those kinds of dialogues with scientists is just really terrific.
Thanks for calling. 1-800-999-8255. Gordon Lark, did you find anything in particular about these Portuguese water dogs that are, make them good to study? I mean, is there something, reason why they would be better than other kinds of dogs?
Well, I think what made them better was just simply that the owners were collaborative and we could get a large amount of data. So we got x-rays from the owners, which we could measure various bone metrics on, and we got blood and so on for genotyping. And the upshot was that we found loci that controlled functional skeletal complexes. That was really sort of a nice finding. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that, for example, is where you have a genetic locus, one or maybe a cluster of genes, that's a trade-off between a large pelvis and thin legs on the one hand and a narrower pelvis, thick legs on another hand. Why have that? Well, a greyhound has huge muscles attached to the pelvis for running.
Right.
But it's got to have thin legs to make that an efficient system. Mm. And it's these trade-offs between different parts of the skeleton that are regulated that seem to us to be quite interesting.
And what exactly, now that you have this population of dogs, what exactly are you looking for?
Well, our main interest is in what's called genetic architecture. We'd like to know how genes are arranged on the genome to regulate any particular function.
How's that different than what Elaine Ostrander is looking for?
Well, we're looking at a much larger, grosser pattern, so to speak. We're trying to find out where genes are linked together and what kind of sense this makes. So far, it looks like it's making functional sense.
Right.
That's the sort of law that's in there. Next, we'd like to know what kind of a network there is between different unlinked genes. Mm-hmm. We know that in something like a soybean, which is highly inbred, there's a tremendous network. But the question is, in an outcrossing system like a dog, what happens? And especially in breeds, inbred dogs, are what you're doing bringing together a coalition of loci, which then get fixed? And these can interact in a particular way. Uh-huh. And this obviously relates then to human isolates and what goes on in human genetics.
Uh-huh. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say the other thing is part of the work that I and my colleagues are doing is aimed at really understanding the organization of all the genes in the genome. So Gordon's particular interests focus on various aspects of morphology, but there are people interested in behavior and people interested in disease susceptibility and everything from coat color to, you know, why some breeds of dog get epilepsy and other breeds don't. And so the Genome Project is very all-encompassing in that it really wants to provide a resource that anyone with any interest in studying the genetics of dog can draw upon.
Yes, right over here in the audience.
Hi. On either the genetic or archaeological side, is there any evidence about whether the domestication of dogs happened in one place or started in one place and spread, or whether it was one of those simultaneous things that happened in a lot of areas?
Well, it's really difficult to say from the genetics. Part of the reason is that the ancestor of dogs, the wolves, they have a very large geographic range. And in wolves, we really don't find genetic markers that tell us it's from a population in central Russia. Wolves move around so much that they're genetically mixed over a very large region. So when we begin to look at dogs, we can't really tie their sequences to wolves from any one place very easily. With regard to the archaeological record, it's rather a mixed story because we have very old remains from the Middle East. We even have a very old remain from Germany. And perhaps the oldest remains are now from central Russia. So there's quite a large area over which we have very old remains from dogs. So it's really difficult to tease it apart exactly.
Did dogs migrate over the Bering Strait when it was easy to do that?
Yes. And we have published some genetic results recently in 2002 that show that dogs of the New World, that is, dogs that we found in archaeological sites where we extracted DNA and characterized it, they have DNA sequences that aren't found in extant dogs and dogs of today. So they were a very different genetic lineage that had a long history of isolation and seemed to have come over with the first Native Americans. And something on the order of 15 to 30,000 years ago, the first Americans arrived. And then about 10,000 years ago, the Bering Land Bridge was submerged. So there was no more immigration after that point. So dogs have been isolated in North America probably for at least 10,000 years, these ancient dogs that we don't seem to have lineages represented today in any extant population.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to John in Hamburg, New York. Hi, John.
How you doing?
Hi.
First, I want to say hello, Seattle.
Hi, Seattle. Okay, I said it for you.
All right, thank you. I have a 10-year-old field named Sarah, and she gets voice cues and hand cues amazing. It's gotten to a point where I could say, Sarah, go left, and she'll go left. And she just knows perhaps the sound or the word. I'm not sure, but she's amazing. And my wife many years ago had a miscarriage, and Sarah was so dutiful. She was on her side the whole time, wouldn't leave her, and we didn't understand why she wouldn't leave my wife's side until what happened. And she just, and during the next pregnancy, she began to lactate. She just had these amazing things happening with her, and I want to know perhaps how involved or how deep the dog can go. Do they sense other things? Do they smell things? Do they react? How could she have known that?
We're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Brian, have you heard stuff like this before?
People have many stories about their dogs doing amazing things, and that was, that question is a good one in that how much do dogs really understand about people? And that's exactly what people like myself are working on. And the caller talked about, perhaps the dog understood something about people's emotions. The dog understood something about the vocal cues and also the signals. And all those were very good observations. And the truth is the research really isn't there yet. And one of the things we're most interested in knowing about dogs right now is, do they just react to motion? Do they, when they see these cues, these social cues that people give off, do they just react to motion, or is it, do they have a deeper understanding, as the caller said, do they think about the thoughts of other people? Are they thinking about what you're thinking? Do they really understand that you have wants and beliefs? And these abilities develop in children at about the age of 4. And so a lot of the tests that we're designing and developing right now to look at chimpanzees and dogs are trying to ask these exact same questions.
Thanks for calling, John. 1-800-989-8255. Of course, if you talk to dog breeders, they'll say, that dog, his 10-year-old Leb, I want to breed that dog because I want to preserve that trait in my next generation. Is that a smart thing to do? I mean, could you be doing too much in breeding and affect the strain?
I think I'm going to hand that over to one of the geneticists.
Elaine?
Sure. Right. So this question comes up of balancing your breeding program because you have certain traits you really want to maintain, be they behavioral or something about the dog's appearance, and yet wanting to keep a healthy line that's relatively disease-free. And so really the best advice is to recommend that healthy dogs be bred to healthy dogs, and that as genetic tests become available for the diseases that are problematic in many breeds, and they're coming online very rapidly at this point, that breeders go ahead and test those. And it's not so much that if a dog carries a mutant gene that could predispose them, if crossed to the wrong individual, predispose their offspring to that disease. It isn't so much that you don't want to keep them in your breeding program. You just want to make sure you don't breed carriers together. Oh. Because those carriers may have other traits which you very much do want to keep in your breeding program. So for the breed clubs to stay abreast of what the genetic tests are that are out there, to use them, and then to design their breeding programs accordingly, keeping those carriers in there but just making sure you keep them away from other carriers is really certainly the way to go.
Robert Wayne, is there a danger too much in breeding breeders here?
Yes, I mean, we have to realize that we potentially cause genetic disease by fixing certain traits in breeds. And also, many of these traits carry with them undesirable side effects. Like, I grew up in Boston, I had a Boston Terrier appropriately, and it's had a very pushed-in rostrum nose, and it had a lot of breeding problems. Now, that pushed-in rostrum was a desirable trait in the origin of the breed, but on the other hand, it carried with it undesirable effects that actually, the animal you might regard as suffering because of those effects. Yeah. So we have to be careful about the associated effects of many of these phenotypes.
All right, we have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk lots more about breeding dogs, their behavior. Questions you'd like to ask, stay with us. We'll be right back with my guests and take your questions in the audience here and at home. So don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about dog genetics and evolution. If I sound like a canine myself today, bear with me. I'm going through a bad cold. My guests are Robert Wayne, Elaine Elstrander, Gordon Lark, and Brian Hare. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go for a question right here in the audience.
Hi, my question is based on the popular saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And what I've noticed is that it's much harder for my parents, and especially grandparents, to learn something new, such as computers, than it is for my younger sister, who picked it up very naturally. And I also know it's hard to teach a dog once it's past a certain age, retrain it or train it for something new. So I was wondering, could dogs be used as a model system to study this learning phenomenon?
Everybody's looking at me. I'm not. I'm not the one. That's a tough question. I mean, go ahead. Brian Hare is going to take a crack at it.
I'll take a stab at it. Which is, I would say that
he's young and foolish. You can tell.
I'm
going to try this one.
I'll try it. Which is that the experiments we've done with dogs, their problem-solving abilities. What we've been looking at is brand new situations they've never encountered before, we find that adult dogs do very well relative to puppies. So I think the old saying needs to be tested, and the data is really not there yet to say that old dogs can't learn new things. In fact, what I've been finding is that this unusual ability that dogs have to pick up these cues and do sort of new things with, that's what's so unusual about it, is that they can generalize to new situations throughout their whole lives. So.
The fact that you were talking about dogs evolving to please their human compatriots, does that also work in the way they look? I mean, to become cuter and have floppy ears and nice cute little tails, is that something to make them more, hey, you know, breed that into me, take me, I'm that sort of Gordon?
I'm not sure I could answer that, actually. I mean, because the question is, how much has a dog been selected by the breeder or the owner, even in prehistoric times?
Right.
And
well, let's say they started out from the wolf. I mean, and now to the dog that we have now.
You certainly know what an aggressive animal, a human knows what an aggressive animal looks like.
Yeah.
And I can see them selecting one that doesn't look aggressive, even though he's a sweetie pie.
Brian?
So there has been an interesting experiment that's been done in Russia by a bunch of Russian geneticists there, where they have experimentally domesticated a group of foxes. And what they found, here's the interesting thing, is they select foxes to breed in the future only based on their behavior, their fear response, and their aggressive response towards a human being. That's the only selection criteria. Yet what they found was that you had a higher level of floppy ears, cute faces, and curly tails and piebald coats that are expressed in the selected foxes relative to other foxes that they didn't select based on anything. So it may be that some of these traits we see in dogs that differ from wolves are actually just incidental byproducts that have been produced because of selection on tame behavior.
So they behave nicely, so we think that's the floppy ears. That's
right.
Yeah, I see. Yes, right here in the audience.
Yes, I'm curious about the health implications for humans. Do we have a feeling for how close in relation we are genetically to dogs and what the implications might be?
Sure. So we know from the sequencing of the 1X sequencing of the poodle genome, which became available several months ago, and that the DNA sequence of dogs and humans is very, very, very similar, as it is for many of the mammals. And certainly dog and human genome sequence is much closer than, for instance, human and mouse or human and rat. And, of course, the mouse has been used for many, many decades as a way of thinking about the genetics of diseases and disease susceptibility. So I think there's a fair amount of excitement in the community about taking advantage of all the breed structure that exists out there, all the different breeds of dogs and all their different particular disease susceptibilities, to identify genes that are responsible for so many different diseases. And what we know so far from the ones that have been looked at, disease is important in metabolic disorders, hemoglobinopathies, our own work in kidney cancer. It's the exact same genes.
Do they get hardening of the arteries and heart disease and things like
they
that?
They sure do get heart disease. That's actually a big problem, especially in many of the larger breeds of dogs. Silent heart attacks and heart defects and valve defects are some of the number one killers for many breeds of dog. So our suspicion and all the data we have so far suggests that it's really going to be the same constellation of genes. Maybe different mutations, different changes at the DNA level, but the same genes causing the same disorders in both.
Mm-hmm. Let's go over here in the audience. Yes, sir.
Yeah, hi. Obviously, through breeding, humans have had a profound effect on the selection of specific traits in dogs, whether for hunting, herding, or something really practical, like looking cute on the cover of a calendar and a pair of roller skates. My question is, is there any evidence that dogs have had an effect on human breeding throughout history? So for cavemen who were dog owners, were their dogs cave chick magnets, in other words?
Well, did they help track? Could they be hunting dogs? I mean, could they have been hunting dogs for... I'll go follow this line a little bit here.
Well, I can jump in. I can't answer that question, but I can answer a slightly different one and tell you what people have been thinking about in terms of human evolution, which is that one of the ideas floating around right now is that after settlement, when people settled, about the time that you see the first archaeological evidence for domesticated dogs, you see some remarkably similar things happen to humans that happen to domesticated animals when they are selected against fear and aggression. And what you see is that you have there's some evidence to suggest that you have a reduction in cranial capacity in humans, that humans become more gracile or that they become thinner, skinnier, and you have several other traits that are also similar. So all I can tell you is that the fact that humans and dogs live together may have something to do with the fact that humans became less aggressive, less impulsive at the same time that dogs did.
Let me just ask this question, because I have a lot of cat friends here. any relationship where cats come into the picture affecting dogs and dog owners, or how dogs developed over history or time? You thought about that at all, Brian? Or Robert, anybody?
Cats are domesticated much more recently, perhaps on the order of a few thousand years ago. So that makes the dogs were already full-blown and diverse by that time. So they came in as...
Because you see the Egyptians and their cats and, you know, deifying things, and you don't see that with dogs, do you? Except for all the constellations have dogs in them.
Well, that's sort of the irony of dogs, is in many cultures they're seen as being pests, yet they've been incredibly successful. Whether they're loved or hated, they won't go away. The other thing I can tell you is, again, we have a situation where in comparing all these different animals and their ability to read human social cues, we haven't looked at cats yet. Now, there's a reason for that. which is we didn't think
get it to behave.
We didn't think they would do it, but
round up those cats.
That's right. So all you cat owners out there, it's ready.
Let's send them to him.
Exactly. No, don't send it to me. you go try it.
But it's a little different. It's a whole different animal. Yes, back of the room here.
Well, this question's following up on a previous question, kind of looking at the different breeds of dogs, and I was curious if your panel could comment on the millions of mutts in the world and the mixed breeds and how that relates to some of the work that you're doing.
Mutts, are they better than purebreds?
You know, people often ask me that question. They say because mutts have sort of hybrid vigor working on their side, are they just going to be healthier than purebred dogs are? And, you know, it really depends what went into the making of that mutt, in fact. And so, you know, there are certainly breeds of dogs that have lots of health problems, and there are other breeds that are just incredibly healthy that live into their mid to late teens, in fact. And there are, you know, mutts that are very healthy and do really well, and there are others that are plagued with lots of hip problems and joint problems and die of cancer and so on. So it kind of depends, you know.
But now you have designer
term.
You have designer mutts now, the schnoodles, the labradoodles.
Yeah.
I mean, how long does it take before they get to be their own genetically,
their own breed?
Is that something that we just decide arbitrarily?
Yeah, no, it's not decided arbitrarily. So the process of becoming, for instance, an AKC or an American Kennel Club registered breed takes, you know, many, many years. And there's, you know, various committees and processes and so on and requirements that have to be met. I don't know if some of you saw the Westminster Dog Show and saw that this was the first year the duck tolling retriever was competing. And so it's wonderful to see these new breeds added all the time. But the breed clubs want to be sure there's a supportive breed club. They want to be sure that these are healthy animals, and that they're going to contribute something to sort of the overall picture of registered dogs. Uh-huh. So you can't just do a couple crosses and then call up the AKC and say, I've got this kind of cool-looking dog here. And they want to make sure that the defining features breed true and all those kinds of requirements are met. And that takes years.
We're talking about dogs this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Here at Seattle at the American Association for the Advancement of Science annual meeting, our number 1-800-989-8255. Robert Wayne, you mentioned something very interesting. You said that I want you to elaborate on this. That most dog breeds sprung up in the last 100 to 200 years. Is that right?
Yes, probably something on the order of 70-80% of dog breeds are relatively recent in origination. So maybe 1800s when the practice of very selective breeding really started to take off.
This is what Elaine was saying about taking time to get a new breed out of all these crossbreeding of the other dogs. It took a couple hundred years.
Well,
or are they something altogether different?
There's probably at least two processes going on here. The first is, and Darwin talked about this, he was really fond of dogs, traveled all around Britain observing
the
practices of breeders. And he observed that occasionally what he called a sport occurred in a litter of pups, where there was a very unusual pup, and that the breeders would then after breed that individual with its litter mates and fix these new mutations, whether it be short-leggedness or unusual coat color. He also talked about crossing distinct breeds. And when you cross them and breed them for a few generations, you get an explosion of variability that gives you a new base to select on. So those two processes were used to generate new different dogs that were then created, that they were in the basis for different breeds. Mm-hmm. So those two practices really led to this diversification of breeds that we see today. Mm-hmm. But there are many ancient breeds still out there, and even I think, to address a previous point, aboriginal populations of dogs, perhaps in South and Central America, that may have a very long pre-ancestry that we haven't really examined genetically in detail.
I only have about a minute left. Elaine Elstrander, how much money is going into this dog genome project compared to the human genome project, and how long do you think before we'll get that whole strand figured out?
So the dog genome project actually begins a decade ago with the development of maps that began to allow us to navigate around the dog's chromosomes. And that's a process that's been going on for 10 years with many, many groups around the world contributing to that. The culmination of that, the real icing on the cake, of course, is the sequencing of the canine genome. And the 6X sequence of the dog is being done now at the Whitehead Center for Genome Research. And that's the result of a white paper on the part of dozens of scientists around the world requesting that the dog genome be sequenced for lots of reasons, including everything we've talked about today. And the final cost of that is a fraction of the cost of the sequencing of the human genome. I think it's on the order of $40 million is what the cost is. But my prediction is we'll more than get that kind of return in terms of what we're going to learn from dogs in terms of their morphology and their health and their behavior.
Have you a target date when you think this would all?
I'm told by my colleagues at the Whitehead that they're expecting sometime this spring.
They're expecting. That's a nice way to...
Yeah, things can happen. Bottlenecks, problems can happen. But it's been moving along very, very well. And they've been making the data available publicly every 24 hours. It's been dumped into the public domain. So an enormous amount of data is already available.
Is there one dog that's chosen for the genome?
There was one dog that was chosen.
Do we know what kind of dog it was?
Yeah, it was chosen. We chose a boxer. And we started out... with this process of how to pick a dog, and we decided very quickly that we had to pick the most inbred dog we could find because it would really facilitate the assembly of the shotgun
box.
Sequence. Yeah. And so we scanned hundreds of dogs, and the most inbred dog that we found of the samples that were submitted, and we put out a call to breeders and to scientists and veterinarians was a boxer.
All right, we've run out of time. Well, now we'll watch to see what the genome of that boxer is. I'd like to thank all my guests, Robert Wayne, evolutionary biologist at UCLA, Elaine Ostrander, is in the Division of Human Biology at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center and an affiliate professor at the University of Washington. Gordon Lark is a professor of biology at the University of Utah in Salt Lake. And Brian Hare is an anthropologist, soon to be at the Max Planck Institute in Germany. Good luck to you over there.
Thank you
all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Kimberly Jones here in Seattle, Matt Galick in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we help today for NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. You can surf over to our website at Science Friday, get free teaching curriculum. We make out of all the shows of Science Friday, give them out to your students and teachers. Also, you can download back editions of Science Friday on your Audible.com player or iPod or any suitable player. We'll be back in New York next week. Thank you all for joining us here in Seattle. I'm Ira Flatow in Seattle.
Support for NPR comes from the Noyce Foundation, dedicated to improving math and science instruction from kindergarten through grade 12, and supporting NPR's Science Friday, sciencefriday.com. From the National Science Foundation, America's investment in the future. From the Annenberg Fund for Excellence in Communications and Education. And from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable, on the web at grdodge.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.